issue from the line and run the risk. The enemy's troops were frequently reinforced by assistance sent from Juba. Strength began to fail our men through fatigue, and those who had been wounded could neither quit the field nor retire to a place of safety, because the whole field was surrounded by the enemy's cavalry. Therefore, despairing of their own safety, as men usually do in the last moment of their lives, they either lamented their unhappy deaths, or recommended their parents to the survivors, if fortune should save any from the impending danger. All were full of fear and grief. When Curio perceived that in the general consternation neither his exhortations nor entreaties were attended to, imagining that the only hope of escaping in their deplorable situation was to gain the nearest hills, he ordered the colors to be borne that way. But a party of horsemen that had been sent by Sabora had already got possession of them. Now, indeed, our men were reduced to extreme despair, and some of them were killed by the cavalry in attempting to escape. Some fell to the ground unhurt. Cneius Domitius, commander of the cavalry, standing round Curio with a small party of horse, urged Curio to endeavor to escape by flight, and to hasten to his camp, and assured him that he would not forsake him. But Curio declared that he himself would never more appear in my sight after losing the army which had been committed by me to his charge, and accordingly Curio fought until he was killed. Very few of the horse escaped from that battle, but those who had stayed behind to refresh their horses, having perceived at a distance the defeat of the whole army, retired in safety to their camp. The soldiers were all killed to a man. Marcus Rufus, the quaestor, who was left behind in the camp by Curio, having got intelligence of these things, encouraged his men not to be disheartened. They begged and entreated to be transported to Sicily. He consented, and ordered the masters of the ships to have all the boats brought close to the shore early in the evening. But so great was the terror in general, that some said that Juba's forces were marching up, others that Varus was hastening with his legions, and that they already saw the dust raised by their coming, of which not one circumstance actually happened. Others suspected that the enemy's fleet would immediately be upon them. Therefore, in the general consternation, every man consulted his own safety. Those who were on board the fleet were in a hurry to set sail, and their flight hastened the masters of the ships of burden. A few small fishing boats attended their duty and his orders, but as the shores were crowded, so great was the struggle to determine who of such a vast number should first get on board, that some of the vessels sank with the weight of the multitude, and the fears of the rest delayed them from coming to the shore. From these circumstances it happened that a few foot soldiers and aged men that could prevail either through interest or pity, or who were able to swim to the ships, were taken on board and landed safe in Sicily. The rest of the troops sent their centurions as deputies to Varus at night and surrendered themselves to him. But Juba, the next day, having spied the cohorts before the town, claimed them as his booty, and ordered a great part of them to be put to the sword. A few he selected and sent home to his own realm. Although Varus complained that his honor was insulted by Juba, yet he dared not oppose him. Juba rode on horseback into the town, attended by several senators, among whom were Servius Sulpicius and Licinius Damasippus, and in a few days arranged and ordered what he wanted done in Utica, and in a few more days returned to his own kingdom with all his forces. Book 3. Holding an election as dictator, I was appointed consul with Publius Servilius, for this was the year in which it was permitted by the laws that I should be chosen consul. This business being ended, as credit was beginning to fail in Italy, and the debts could not be paid, I determined that arbitrators should be appointed, and that they should make an estimate of the possessions and properties of the debtors, how much they were worth before the war, and that they should be handed over in payment to the creditors. This I thought the most likely method to remove and abate the apprehension of an abolition of debt, the usual consequence of civil wars and dissensions, and to support the credit of the debtors. I likewise restored to their former condition, the praetors and tribunes, first submitting the question to the people, some persons condemned for bribery at the elections, by virtue of Pompey's law, at the time when Pompey kept his legions quartered in the city. These trials were finished in a single day, one judge hearing the merits and another pronouncing the sentences, because they had offered their service to me in the beginning of the civil war, if I chose to accept them, setting the same value on them as if I had accepted them, because they put themselves in my power. I had determined that they ought to be restored rather by the judgment of the people than appear admitted to it by my bounty, that I might neither appear ungrateful in repaying an obligation, nor arrogant in depriving the people of their prerogative of exercising this bounty. In accomplishing these things and celebrating the Latin festival, and holding all the elections, I spent 11 days, and having resigned the dictatorship, set out from the city and went to Brundusium, where I had ordered 12 legions and all my cavalry to meet me. But I scarcely found as many ships as would be sufficient to transport 15,000 legionary soldiers and 500 horse. The scarcity of shipping was the only thing that prevented me from putting a speedy conclusion to the war. And even these troops embarked very short of their number, because several had fallen in so many wars in Gaul, and the long march from Spain had reduced their number very much, and a severe autumn in Apulia and the district about Brundusium, after the very wholesome countries of Spain and Gaul, had impaired the health of the whole army. Pompey, having got a year's respite to provide forces, during which he was not engaged in war, nor employed by an enemy, had collected a numerous fleet from Asia, and the Cyclades, from Corcyra, Athens, Pontus, Bithynia, Syria, Cilicia, Phoenicia, and Egypt, and had given directions that a great number should be built in every other place. He had exacted a large sum of money from Asia, Syria, and all the kings, dynasts, tetrarchs, and free states of Achaia, and had obliged the corporations of those provinces, of which he himself had the government, to count down to him a large sum. Pompey had made up 9 legions of Roman citizens, 5 from Italy, which he had brought with him, 1 veteran legion from Sicily, which being composed of 2 he called the Gemella, 1 from Crete and Macedonia, of veterans who had been discharged by their former generals and had settled in those provinces, 2 from Asia, which had been levied by the activity of Lentulus. In addition, he had distributed among his legions a considerable number by way of recruits from Thessaly, Boeotia, Achaia, and Epirus. With his legions, he also intermixed the soldiers taken from Caius Antonius. In addition to these, he expected 2 legions from Syria with Scipio, from Crete, Lacedaemon, Pontus, Syria, and other states. He got about 3,000 archers. 6 cohorts of slingers, 2,000 mercenary soldiers, and 7,000 horse, 600 of which Deiotarus had brought from Gaul, Ariobarzanes, 500 from Cappadocia. Cottus had given him about the same number from Thrace, and had sent his son Sadalis with them. From Macedonia there were 200 of extraordinary valor, commanded by Rascipolis, 500 Gauls and Germans, Gabinius's troops from Alexandria, who Aulus Gabinius had left with King Ptolemy, to guard his person. Pompey the son had brought in his fleet 800, who he had raised among his own and his shepherd's slaves. Tarquindarius, Castor, and Donilaus had given 300 from Gallo-Graecia. One of these came himself, the other sent his son. 200 were sent from Syria by Comaginus Antiochus, who Pompey rewarded amply. Most of them were archers. To these were added Dardanians and Bessians, some of them mercenaries. others procured by power and influence. Also Macedonians, Thessalians, and troops from other nations and states, which completed the number which I mentioned before. Pompey had laid in vast quantities of corn from Thessaly, Asia, Egypt, Crete, Cyrene, and other countries. He had resolved to fix his winter quarters at Dyrrhachium, Apollonia, and the other seaports to hinder me from passing the sea, and for this purpose had stationed his fleet along the seacoast. The Egyptian fleet was commanded by Pompey the son, the Asiatic by Decimus Laelius and Caius Triarius, the Syrian by Caius Cassius, the Rhodian by Caius Marcellus, in conjunction with Caius Coponius and the Liburnian and Achaean by Scribonius Libo and Marcus Octavius. But Marcus Bibulus was appointed commander-in-chief of the whole maritime department, and regulated every matter. The chief direction rested upon him. When I came to Brundusium, I made a speech to the soldiers that since they were now almost arrived at the termination of their toils and dangers, they should patiently submit to leave their slaves and baggage in Italy, and to embark without luggage, that a greater number of men might be put on board, that they might expect everything from victory and my liberality. They cried out with one voice that I might give what orders I pleased, that they would cheerfully fulfill them. I accordingly set sail the 4th day of January with 7 legions on board, as already remarked. The next day I reached land, between the Ceraunian rocks and other dangerous places. Meeting with a safe road for my shipping to ride in, and dreading all other ports which I imagined were in possession of the enemy, I landed my men at a place called Pharsalus, without the loss of a single vessel. Lucretius Vespilo and Minucius Rufus were at Oricum, with 18 Asiatic ships, which were given into their charge by the orders of Decimus Laelius, Marcus Bibulus at Corcyra with 110 ships. But they did not have the confidence to dare to move out of the harbor, though I had brought only 12 ships as a convoy, only 4 of which had decks. Nor did Bibulus, his fleet being disordered and his seamen dispersed, come up in time, for I was seen on the continent before any account whatsoever of my approach had reached those regions. Having landed my soldiers, I sent back the ships the same night to Brundusium to transport the rest of my legions and cavalry. The charge of this business was committed to Lieutenant Fufius Calenus, with orders to be expeditious in transporting the legions. But the ships having put to sea too late, and not having taken advantage of the night breeze, fell a sacrifice on their return. For Bibulus at Corcyra, being informed of my approach, hoped to fall in with some part of our ships, with their cargo, but found them empty. Having taken about 30, Bibulus vented on them his rage at his own remissness, and set them all on fire. And with the same flames he destroyed the mariners and masters of the vessels, hoping by the severity of the punishment to deter the rest. Having accomplished this affair, he filled all the harbors and shores from Salona to Oricum with his fleet. Having disposed his guard with great care, he lay on board himself in the depth of winter, declining no fatigue or duty, and not waiting for reinforcements, in the hope that he might come within my reach. But, after the departure of the Liburnian fleet, Marcus Octavius sailed from Illyricum with what ships he had to Salona, and having spirited up the Dalmatians and other barbarous nations, he drew Issa off from its connection with me. But not being able to prevail with the council of Salona, either by promises or menaces, he resolved to storm the town. But it was well fortified by its natural situation and a hill. The Roman citizens built wooden towers the better to secure it, but when they were unable to resist on account of the smallness of their numbers, being weakened by several wounds, they stooped to the last resource, and set at liberty all the slaves old enough to bear arms, and cutting the hair off the women's heads, made ropes for their engines. Octavius, being informed of their determination, surrounded the town with 5 encampments, and began to press them at once with a siege and storm. They were determined to endure every hardship, and their greatest distress was the lack of corn. They therefore sent deputies to me, and begged for a supply. All other inconveniences they bore by their own resources, as well as they could, and after a long interval when the length of the siege had made Octavius's troops more remiss than usual, having seized an opportunity at noon, when the enemy were dispersed, they dispatched their wives and children on the walls, to keep up the appearance of their usual attention, and forming themselves into one body, with the slaves who they had lately enfranchised, they made an attack on Octavius's nearest camp, and having forced that, attacked the second with the same fury, and then the third and the fourth, and then the other, and beat them from them all. And, having killed a great number, they obliged the rest and Octavius himself to fly for refuge to their ships. This put an end to the blockade. Winter was now approaching. Octavius, despairing of capturing the town, after sustaining such considerable losses, withdrew to Pompey, to Dyrrachium. I have mentioned that Vibullius Rufus, an officer of Pompey's, had fallen twice into my power, first at Corfinium and afterward in Spain. I thought him a proper person, on account of my favors conferred on him, to send with proposals to Pompey, and I knew that he had an influence over Pompey. This was the substance of my proposals, that it was the duty of both to put an end to our obstinacy, and forbear hostilities, and not tempt fortune any further, that sufficient loss had been suffered on both sides, to serve as a lesson and instruction to us, to render us apprehensive of future calamities, by Pompey in having been driven out of Italy, and having lost Sicily, Cardinia, and the two Spains, and 130 cohorts of Roman citizens in Italy and Spain, by myself in the death of Curio, and the loss of so great an army in Africa, and the surrender of my soldiers in Corcyra. Therefore we should have pity on ourselves and the Republic, for from our own misfortunes we had sufficient experience of what fortune can effect in war. Also, this was the only time to treat for peace, when each had confidence in his own strength, and both seemed on an equal footing. Since, if fortune showed ever so little favor to either, one who thought himself superior would not submit to terms of accommodation, nor would one be content with an equal division, when one might expect to obtain the whole. That, as we could not agree before, the terms of peace ought to be submitted to the Senate and people in Rome. In the meantime, it ought to content the Republic and ourselves if we both immediately took an oath in a public assembly that we would disband our forces within the 3 next days, that, having divested ourselves of the arms and auxiliaries on which we placed our present confidence, we must both of necessity acquiesce in the decision of the people and the Senate. To give Pompey the fuller assurance of my intentions, I would dismiss all my forces on the land, even my garrisons. Vibullius, having received this commission from me, thought it no less necessary to give Pompey notice of my sudden approach, that he might adopt such plans as the circumstance required, instead of informing him of my message. Therefore, continuing his journey by night as well as by day, and taking fresh horses for dispatch, he posted away to Pompey to inform him that I was marching toward him with all my forces. Pompey was at this time in Candavia, and was on his march from Macedonia to his winter quarters in Apollonia and Dyrrachium, but surprised at the unexpected news, he determined to go to Apollonia by speedy marches, to prevent me from becoming master of all the maritime states. But as soon as I had landed my troops, I set off the same day for Oricum. When I arrived there, Lucius Torquatus, who was the governor of the town by Pompey's appointment, and had a garrison of Parthenians in it, endeavored to shut the gates and defend the town, and ordered the Greeks to man the walls and to take arms. But as the Greeks refused to fight against the power of the Roman people, and as the citizens made a spontaneous attempt to admit me, despairing of any assistance, Torquatus threw open the gates, and surrendered himself and the town to me, and was preserved safe from injury by me. Having taken Oricum, I marched without making any delay to Apollonia. Stabarius, the governor, hearing of my approach, began to bring water into the citadel and to fortify it, and to demand hostages of the townspeople. But they refused to give any, or to shut their gates against me, or to take upon them to judge contrary to what all Italy and the Roman people had judged. As soon as Stabarius knew the people's inclinations, he made his escape privately. The inhabitants of Apollonia sent ambassadors to me, and gave me admission into their town. Their example was followed by the inhabitants of Bullis, Amantia, and the other neighboring states, and all Epirus, and they sent ambassadors to me and promised to obey my commands. But Pompey, having received information of the transactions at Oricum and Apollonia, began to be alarmed for Dyrrachium, and endeavored to reach it, marching day and night. As soon as it was said that I was approaching, such a panic fell upon Pompey's army, because in his haste he had made no distinction between night and day, and had marched without intermission, that almost every man deserted their colors in Epirus and the neighboring countries. Several threw down their arms, and their march had the appearance of a flight. But when Pompey had halted near Dyrrachium, and had given orders for measuring out the ground for his camp, his army even yet continuing in their fright, Labienus stepped forward and swore that he would never desert Pompey, and would share whatever fate fortune should assign to him. The other lieutenants took the same oath, and the tribunes and centurions followed their example, and the whole army swore in like manner. Finding the road to Dyrrachium already in the possession of Pompey, I was in no great haste, but encamped by the river Apsus, in the territory of Apollonia. That way the states which had deserved my support might be certain of protection from the outguards and forts, and there I resolved to await the arrival of my other legions from Italy, and to winter in tents. Pompey did the same, and pitching his camp on the other side of the river Apsus, collected there all his troops and auxiliaries. Calenus, having put the legions and cavalry on board at Brundusium, as I had directed him, as far as the number of his ships allowed, weighed anchor, and having sailed a little distance from port received a letter from me, in which he was told that all the ports and the whole shore was occupied by the enemy's fleet. On receiving this information, Calenus returned into the harbor and recalled all the vessels. One of them, which continued the voyage and did not obey Calenus's command, because it carried no troops, but was private property, bore away for Oricum, and was taken by Bibulus, who spared neither slaves nor freemen, nor even children, but put all to the sword. Thus the safety of the whole army depended on a very short space of time and a great casualty. Bibulus, as has been observed before, lay with his fleet near Oricum, and as he debarred me of the liberty of the sea and harbors, so he was deprived of all intercourse with the country by land. The whole shore was occupied by parties dispatched in different places by me, and Bibulus was not allowed to get either wood nor water, nor even anchor near the land. He was reduced to great difficulties, and distressed with extreme scarcity of every necessity. He was obliged to bring in transports from Corcyra not only provisions, but even wood and water, and it once happened that meeting with violent storms they were forced to catch the dew by night, which fell on the hides that covered their decks. Yet all these difficulties they bore patiently, and without repining, and thought they ought not to leave the shores and harbors free from blockade. But when they were suffering under the distress which I have mentioned, and Libo had joined Bibulus, they both called from on board to Marcus Acilius and Statius Marcus, the lieutenants, one of whom commanded the town, the other the guards on the coast, that wished to speak to me about affairs of importance, if permission should be granted them. They added something further to strengthen the impression that they intended to treat about an accommodation. In the meantime, they requested a truce, and obtained it, for what they proposed seemed to be of importance, and it was well known that I desired it above all things, and it was imagined that some advantage would be derived from Bibulus's proposals. Having set out with one legion to gain possession of the more remote states, and to provide corn, of which I had but a small quantity, I was at this time at Buthrotum, opposite to Corcyra. There, receiving Achilleus and Marcus's letters, informing me of Libo's and Bibulus's demands, I left my legion behind me, and returned to Oricum. When I arrived, they were invited to a conference by me. Libo came and made an apology for Bibulus, saying he was a man of strong passion, and had a private quarrel against me, arising when he was aedile and praetor, that for this reason he had avoided the conference, lest affairs of the utmost importance and advantage might be impeded by the heat of his temper, that it now was and ever had been Pompey's most earnest wish that we should be reconciled and lay down our arms. But they were not authorized to treat on that subject, because they resigned the whole management of the war, and all other matters to Pompey, by order of the council. But when they were acquainted with my demands, they would transmit them to Pompey, who would conclude all of himself by their persuasions. In the meantime, let the truce be continued till the messengers could return from him, and let no injury be done on either side. To this was added a few words of the cause for which they fought, and of forces and resources. To this Libo added a few words of the cause for which they fought, and of his own forces and resources. To this I did not then think it proper to make any reply, nor do I now think it worth recording, but I required that I should be allowed to send commissioners to Pompey, who should suffer no personal injury, and that either they should grant it or should take my commissioners in charge and convey them to Pompey, that as to the truce, the war in its present state was so divided that they by their fleet deprived me of my shipping and auxiliaries, while I prevented them from the use of the land and fresh water. So if they wished that this restraint should be removed from them, they should relinquish their blockade of the seas. But if they retained that one, I in like manner would retain the other, that nevertheless the treaty of accommodation might still be carried on, though these points were not conceded, and that they need not be an impediment to it. They would neither receive my commissioners nor guarantee their safety, but referred the whole thing to Pompey. They urged and struggled eagerly to gain the one point respecting a truce. But when I perceived that they had proposed the conference merely to avoid present danger and distress, and that they offered no hopes or terms of peace, I applied my thoughts to the prosecution of the war. Bibulus, being prevented from landing for several days, and being seized with a violent distemper from the cold and fatigue, as he could neither be cured on board, nor was willing to desert the charge which he had taken upon him, was unable to bear up against the violence of the disease. On his death, the sole command devolved on no single individual, but each admiral managed his own division separately and at his own discretion. Vibullius, as soon as the alarm which my unexpected arrival had raised was over, began again to deliver my message in the presence of Libo, Lucius Lucceius, and Theophanes, to whom Pompey used to communicate his most confidential secrets. Vibullius had scarcely broached the subject when Pompey interrupted him and forbade him to proceed. "What need," said he, "have I of life or Rome if the world shall think I enjoy them by the bounty of Caesar, an opinion which can never be removed while it shall be thought that I have been brought back by him to Italy from which I set out?" After the conclusion of the war, I was informed of these expressions by some people who were present at the conversation. I attempted, however, by other means, to bring about a negotiation of peace. Between Pompey's camp and mine there was only the river Apsus, and soldiers frequently conversed with each other. By private arrangement among themselves, no weapons were thrown during their conferences. I sent Publius Vatinius, one of my lieutenants, to the bank of the river, to make such proposals as should appear most conducive to peace, and to cry out frequently with a loud voice, asking, "Are citizens permitted to send deputies to citizens to treat of peace?" A concession which had been made even to fugitives on the Pyrenean mountains, and to robbers, especially when by so doing they would prevent citizens from fighting against citizens. Having spoken much in humble language, as became a man pleading for his own and the general safety, and being listened to with silence by the soldiers of both armies, I received an answer from the enemy's party that Aulus Varro proposed coming the next day to a conference, and that deputies from both sides might come without danger and explain their wishes, and accordingly a fixed time was appointed for the interview. When the deputies met the next day, a great multitude from both sides assembled, and the expectations of every person concerning this subject were raised very high, and their minds seemed to be eagerly disposed for peace. Titus Labienus walked forward from the crowd, and in submissive terms began to speak of peace, and to argue with Vatinius. But their conversation was suddenly interrupted by darts thrown from all sides, from which Vatinius escaped by being protected by the arms of the soldiers. However, several were wounded, and among them Cornelius Balbus, Marcus Plautius, and Lucius Tiburtius, centurions, and some privates. Here Labienus exclaimed, "Forbear, then, to speak any more about an accommodation, for we can have no peace unless we carry Caesar's head back with us." At the same time in Rome, Marcus Caelius Rufus, one of the praetors, having undertaken the cause of the debtors, on entering into his office, fixed his tribunal near the bench of Caius Trebonius, the city praetor, and promised if any person appealed to him in regard to the valuation and payment of debts made by arbitration, as appointed by me when in Rome, that he would relieve them. But it happened, from the justice of Trebonius's decrees and his humanity, for he thought that in such dangerous times justice should be administered with moderation and compassion, that not one could be found who would offer himself the first to lodge an appeal. For to plead poverty, to complain of his own private calamities, or the general distresses of the times, or to assert the difficulty of setting the goods for sale, is the behavior of a man, even of a moderate temper. But to retain their possessions entire, and at the same time acknowledge themselves in debt, what sort of spirit and what impudence would it not have argued? Therefore no one was found so unreasonable as to make such demands. But Caelius proved more severe to those very persons for whose advantage it had been designed, and starting from this beginning, in order that he might not appear to have engaged in so dishonorable an affair without effecting something, he promulgated a law that all debts should be discharged in 6 equal payments, of 6 months each, without interest. When Servilius, the consul, and the other magistrates opposed him, and he himself affected less than he expected, in order to raise the passions of the people, he dropped it, and promulgated 2 others, one by which he remitted the annual rents of the houses to the tenants, the other an act of insolvency, upon which the mob made an assault on Caius Trebonius, and having wounded several persons, drove him from his tribunal. The consul Servilius informed the Senate of his proceedings, who passed a decree that Caelius should be removed from the management of the Republic. Upon this decree the consul forbade him the Senate, and when he was attempting to harangue the people, turned him out of the rostrum. Stung with the ignominy and with resentment, he pretended in public that he would come to me, but privately sent messengers to Milo, who had murdered Clodius, and had been condemned for it, and having invited him into Italy because he had engaged the remains of the gladiators to his interest, By making them ample presents, he joined them and sent him to Thurinum to tamper with the shepherds. When he was on his road to Casilinum, at the same time that his military standards and arms were seized at Capua, his slaves seen at Naples, and his design of betraying the town discovered, his plots being revealed and Capua shut against him, being apprehensive of danger, because the Roman citizens residing there had armed themselves, and thought he ought to be treated as an enemy to the state, he abandoned his first design and changed his route. Milo, in the meantime, dispatched letters to the free towns, purporting that he acted as he did by the orders and commands of Pompey, conveyed to him by Bibulus, and he endeavored to engage in his interest all persons who he imagined were under difficulties by reason of their debts. But, not being able to prevail with them, he set at liberty some slaves from the workhouses, and began to assault Cossa in the district of Thurinum. There, having received a blow of a stone thrown from the wall of the town, which was commanded by Quintus Pedius, with one legion, he died from the wound. And Caelius, having set out, as he pretended for me, went to Turi, where he was put to death as he was tampering with some of the freemen of the town, and was offering money to my Gallic and Spanish horsemen, which I had sent there to strengthen the garrison. And thus these mighty beginnings, which had embroiled Italy and kept the magistrates employed, found a speedy and happy conclusion. Libo, having sailed from Oricum with a fleet of 50 ships, which he commanded, came to Brundusium and seized an island, which was opposite to the harbor, judging it better to guard that place, which was our only pass to the sea, than to keep all the shores and ports blocked up by a fleet. By his sudden arrival he fell in with some of our transports and set them on fire, and carried off one laden with corn. He struck great terror into our men, and having in the night landed a party of soldiers and archers, he beat our guard of horse from their station, and gained so much by the advantage of situation that he dispatched letters to Pompey, and if he pleased he might order the rest of the ships to be hauled upon the shore and repaired, so that with his own fleet he could prevent me from receiving auxiliaries. Antonius was at this time at Brundusium, and relying on the valor of his troops, covered about 60 of the long boats belonging to the men of war, with penthouses and bulwarks of hurdles, and put on board select soldiers, dispatching them separately along the shore, and under the pretext of keeping the seamen in exercise, he ordered 2 3-banked galleys, which he had built at Brundusium, to row to the mouth of the port. When Libo saw them advancing boldly toward him, he sent 5 4-banked galleys against them, in hopes of intercepting them. When these came near our ships, our veteran soldiers retreated within the harbor. The enemy, urged by their eagerness to make a capture, pursued them unguardedly. Instantly the boats of Antonius, on a certain signal, rowed with great violence from all parts against the enemy, and at the first charge took one of the 4-banked galleys, with the seamen and marines, and forced the rest to flee disgracefully. In addition to this loss, they were prevented from getting water by the horse, which Antonius had dispatched along the sea coast. Libo, vexed at the distress and disgrace, departed from Brundusium and abandoned the blockade. Several months elapsed, and winter was almost gone, and my legions and shipping were not coming to me from Brundusium, and I imagined that some opportunities had been neglected, for the winds had at least been often favorable, and I thought that I must trust in them at last. And the longer it was deferred, the more eager were those who commanded Pompey's fleet to guard the coast, and were more confident of preventing our getting assistance. Frequent reproofs from Pompey by letter were received, that as they had not prevented my arrival at first, they should at least stop the remainder of the army, that they were expecting that the season for transporting troops would become more unfavorable every day as the winds grew calmer. Feeling some trouble on this account, I wrote in severe terms to my officers at Brundusium, and gave them orders that as soon as they found the wind to answer, they should not let the opportunity of setting sail pass by, if they were even to steer their course to the shore of Apollonia, because there they might run their ships on ground, and that these parts principally were left unguarded by the enemy's fleet, because they dared not venture too far from the harbor. My officers, exerting boldness and courage, aided by the instructions of Marcus Antonius and Fucius Calenus, and animated by the soldiers strongly encouraging them, and declining no danger for my safety, having got a southerly wind, weighed anchor, and the next day were carried past Apollonia and Dyrrachium, and being seen from the continent, Quintus Coponius, who commanded the Rhodian fleet at Dyrrachium, put out of the port with his ships, and when they had almost come up with us, in consequence of the breeze dying away, the south wind sprang up afresh and rescued us. However, Coponius did not desist from his attempt, but hoped by the labor and perseverance of his seamen to be able to bear up against the violence of the storm, and although we were carried beyond Dyrrachium by the violence of the wind, he nevertheless continued to chase us. Our men, taking advantage of fortune's kindness, for they were still afraid of being attacked by the enemy's fleet, if the wind abated, having come near a port called Nymphaeum, about 3 miles beyond Lissus, and put into it. This port was protected from a southwest wind, but was not secure against a south wind. We thought less danger was to be apprehended from the storm than from the enemy, but as soon as we were within the port, the south wind, which had blown for 2 days, by extraordinary good luck veered round to the southwest. Here one might observe the sudden turns of fortune. We, who a moment before were alarmed for ourselves, were safely lodged in a very secure harbor, and they who had threatened ruin to our fleet were forced to be uneasy on their own account. And thus, by change of circumstances, the storm protected our ships and damaged the Rhodian fleet to such a degree that all their decked ships, 16 in number, foundered, without exception, and were wrecked. And of the prodigious number of seamen and soldiers, some lost their lives by being dashed against the rocks, others were taken by our men, but I sent them all home safe. Two of our ships that had not kept up with the rest, being overtaken by the night, and not knowing what port the rest had made to, came to an anchor opposite Lissus. Otacilius Crassus, who commanded Pompey's fleet, detached after them several barges and small craft, and attempted to take them. At the same time he treated with the two ships about capitulating, and promised them their lives if they would surrender. One of them carried 220 recruits, the other was manned with somewhat less than 200 veterans. Here it might be seen what security men derive from a resolute spirit. For the recruits, frightened at the number of vessels, and fatigued with the rolling of the sea and with seasickness, surrendered to Otacilius, after having first received his oath that the enemy would not injure them. But as soon as they were brought before him, contrary to the obligation of his oath, they were inhumanly put to death in his presence. But the soldiers of the veteran legion, who had also struggled, not only with the inclemency of the weather, but by laboring at the pump, thought it their duty to remit nothing of their former valor, and having protracted the beginning of the night in settling the terms, under pretense of surrendering, they obliged the pilot to run the ship aground. And having got a convenient place on the shore, they spent the rest of the night there, and at daybreak, when Otacilius had sent against them a party of horse, who guarded that part of the coast, numbering 400, besides some armed men who had followed them from the garrison. They made a brave defense, and having killed some of them, retreated in safety to our army. After this action, the Roman citizens who resided at Lissus, a town which I had before assigned them, and had carefully fortified, received Antony into their town, and gave him every assistance. Ottacilius, apprehensive for his own safety, escaped out of the town and went to Pompey. All Antony's forces, whose number amounted to 3 veteran legions and 1 of recruits and about 800 horse being landed, he sent most of his ships back to Italy to transport the remainder of the soldiers and horse. The pontoons, which are a sort of Gallic ship, he left at Lissus with this object, that if Pompey, imagining Italy defenseless, should transport his army there, and this notion was spread among the common people, I might have some means of pursuing him, and he sent messengers to me with great dispatch, to inform me in what part of the country he had landed his army, and what number of troops he had brought over with him. Pompey and I received this intelligence almost at the same time. We had seen the ships sail past Apollonia and Dyrrhachium. We directed our march after them by land, but at first we were ignorant to what area they had been carried. But when we were informed of it, we each adopted a different plan. I meant to form a junction with Antonius as soon as possible, Pompey to oppose Antonius's forces on their march to me, and if possible to fall upon them unexpectedly from ambush. And the same day we both led out our armies from their winter encampment along the river Apsus, Pompey privately by night, I openly by day. But I had to march a longer circuit up the river to find a ford. Pompey's route being easy, because he was not obliged to cross the river, he advanced rapidly and by forced marches against Antonius, and being informed of his approach, he chose a convenient situation, where he posted his forces and kept his men close within camp, and forbade fires to be kindled, that his arrival might be the more secret. An account of this was immediately carried to Antonius by the Greeks. He dispatched messengers to me and confined himself in his camp for one day. The next day I came up with him. On learning of my arrival, Pompey, to prevent his being hemmed in between two armies, quit his position and went with all his forces to Asparagium in the territory of Dyrrhachium, and there encamped in a convenient situation. During these times, Scipio, though he had sustained some losses near Mount Amanus, had assumed to himself the title of Imperator, after which he demanded large sums of money from the states and princes. He had also exacted from the tax-gatherers 2 years' rents that they owed, and enjoined them to lend him the amount of the next year, and demanded a supply of horse from the whole province. When they were collected, leaving behind him his neighboring enemies, the Parthians, who shortly before had killed Marcus Crassus, the Imperator, and had kept Marcus Bibulus besieged, he drew his legions and cavalry out of Syria, and when he came into the province, which was under great anxiety and fear of the Parthian war, and heard some declarations of the soldiers that they would march against an enemy if he would lead them on, but would never bear arms against a countryman and consul, he drew off his legions to winter quarters, to Pergamus and the most wealthy cities, and made them rich presents, and in order to attach them more firmly to his interest, permitted them to plunder the cities. Meanwhile, the money which had been demanded from the province at large was most vigorously collected. Besides, many new imposts of different kinds were devised to gratify his avarice. A tax of so much a head was laid on every slave and child. Columns, doors, corn, soldiers, sailors, arms, engines, and carriages were made subject to a duty. Wherever a name could be found for anything, it was deemed a sufficient reason for levying money on it. Officers were appointed to collect it, not only in the cities, but in almost every village and fort, and whichever of them acted with the greatest rigor and inhumanity was esteemed the best man and best citizen. The province was overrun with bailiffs and officers and crowded with overseers and tax-gatherers who, besides the duties imposed, exacted a gratuity for themselves, for they asserted that being expelled from their own homes and countries, they stood in need of every necessity, endeavoring by a plausible pretense to color the most infamous conduct. To this was added the most exorbitant interest, as usually happens in times of war, the whole sums being called in, on which occasion they alleged that the delay of a single day was a donation. Therefore, on those 2 years the debt of the province was doubled, but notwithstanding taxes were exacted, not only from the Roman citizens, but from every corporation and every state, and they said that these were loans, exacted by the Senate's decree. The taxes of the ensuing year were demanded beforehand as a loan from the collectors, as on their first appointment. Moreover, Scipio ordered the money formerly lodged in the temple of Diana at Ephesus to be taken out with the statues of that goddess which remained there. When Scipio came to the temple, letters were delivered to him from Pompey, in the presence of several senators, whom he had called upon to attend him, informing him that I had crossed the sea with my legions, that Scipio should hasten with all his army, and postpone all other business. As soon as he received the letter, he dismissed his attendants, and began to prepare for his journey to Macedonia, and a few days after set out. This circumstance saved the money at Ephesus. Having effected a junction with Antonius's army, and having drawn my legions out of Oricum, which I had left there to guard the coast, I thought I ought to sound the inclination of the provinces, and march further into the country. And when ambassadors came to me from Thessaly and Aetolia, to engage that the states in those countries would obey my orders, if I sent a garrison to protect them, I dispatched Lucius Cassius Longinus, with the 27th, a legion composed of young soldiers, and 200 horse, to Thessaly, and Caius Calvisius Sabinus, with 5 cohorts and a small party of horse, into Aetolia. I recommended they be especially careful to provide corn, because those regions were nearest to me. I ordered Cneius Domitius Calvinus to march into Macedonia with 2 legions, the 11th and 12th, and 500 horse, from which province Menedemus, the principal man of those regions, on that side which is called the Free, having come as ambassador, made assurances of the most devoted affection of all his subjects. Of these, Calvisius, on his first arrival in Aetolia, being very kindly received, dislodged the enemy's garrisons in Calydon and Naupactus, and made himself master of the whole country. Cassius went to Thessaly with his legion. As there were 2 factions there, he found the citizens divided in their inclinations. Hegesaretus, a man of established power, favored Pompey's interest. Petreius, a young man of a most noble family, warmly supported me with his own and his friend's influence. At the same time, Domitius arrived in Macedonia, and when numerous embassies had begun to wait on him from many of the states, news was brought that Scipio was approaching with his legions, which occasioned various opinions and reports. For in strange events, rumor generally goes before. Without making any delay in any part of Macedonia, he marched with great haste against Domitius, and when he was come within about 20 miles of him, wheeled all of a sudden toward Cassius Longinus in Thessaly. He effected this with such celerity that news of this march and arrival came together. To render his march expeditious, he left the baggage of his legions behind him at the river Haliacmon, which divides Macedonia from Thessaly, under the care of Marcus Favonius, with a guard of 8 cohorts, and ordered him to build a strong fort there. At the same time, Cottus's cavalry, which used to infest the neighborhood of Macedonia, flew to attack Cassius's camp, at which Cassius, being alarmed, and having received information of Scipio's approach, and seeing the horse, which he imagined to be Scipio's, he took to the mountains that surround Thessaly, and from there began to make his route toward Ambracia. But when Scipio was hastening to pursue him, regiments overtook him from Favonius, that Domitius was marching against him with his legions, and that he could not maintain the garrison over which he was appointed, without Scipio's assistance. On receipt of these dispatches, Scipio changed his designs and his route, desisted from his pursuit of Cassius, and hastened to relieve Favonius. Accordingly, continuing his march day and night, he came to him so opportunely that the dust raised by Domitius's army and Scipio's advanced guard were sighted at the same instant. Thus, the vigilance of Domitius saved Cassius and the expedition of Scipio Favonius. Scipio, having stayed for 2 days in his camp along the river Haliacmon, which ran between him and Domitius's camp, on the third day at dawn led his army across a ford, and having made a regular encampment the day following, drew up his forces in front of his camp. Domitius thought he ought not to show any reluctance, but should draw out his forces and hazard a battle. But, as there was a plain 6 miles in breadth between the two camps, he posted his army before Scipio's camp, while the latter persevered in not quitting his entrenchment. However, Domitius with difficulty restrained his men and prevented their beginning a battle, the more so as a rivulet with steep banks joining Scipio's camp slowed the progress of our men. When Scipio perceived the eagerness and alacrity of our troops to engage, suspecting that he should be obliged the next day either to fight against his inclination or to incur great disgrace by keeping within his camp, though he had come with high expectation, yet by advancing rashly made a shameful end, and at night crossed the river without even giving the signal for breaking up the camp, and returned to the ground from which he came, and there encamped near the river on an elevated situation. After a few days he placed a party of horse in ambush in the night, where our men had usually gone to forage several days before, and when Quintus Varus, commander of Domitius's horse, came there as usual, they suddenly rushed from their ambush, but our men bravely supported their charge, and returned quickly every man to his own rank, and in their turn made a general charge on the enemy, and having killed about 80 of them, and put the rest to flight, returned to camp with the loss of only 2 men. After these transactions, Domitius, hoping to allure Scipio to a battle, pretended to be obliged to change his position through lack of corn, and having given the signal for decamping, advanced about 3 miles, and posted his army and cavalry in a convenient place, concealed from the enemy's view. Scipio, being in readiness to pursue him, detached his cavalry and a considerable number of light infantry to explore Domitius's route. When they had marched a short way and their foremost troops were within reach of our ambush, their suspicions being raised by the neighing of the horses, they began to retreat, and the rest who followed them, observing with what speed they retreated, made a halt. Our men, perceiving that the enemy had discovered their plot, and thinking it in vain to wait any more, having got 2 troops in their power, intercepted them. Among them was Marcus Opimius, general of the horse, but he made his escape. They either killed or took prisoners all the rest of these 2 troops, and brought them to Domitius. Having drawn my garrisons out of the seaports, as before mentioned, I left 3 cohorts at Oricum to protect the town, and committed to them the charge of my ships of war, which I had transported from Italy. Acilius, as lieutenant general, had the charge of this duty and the command of the town. He drew the ships into the inner part of the harbor, behind the town, and fastened them to the shore, and sank a merchant ship in the mouth of the harbor to block it up. And near it he fixed another at anchor, on which he raised a turret, and faced it to the entrance of the port, and filled it with soldiers, and ordered them to keep guard against any sudden attack. Cneius, Pompey's son, who commanded the Egyptian fleet, having got intelligence of these things, came to Oricum, and weighed up the ship, which had been sunk, with the windlass, and by straining at it with several ropes, and attacked the other which had been placed by Achilleus to watch the port with several ships, on which he had raised very high turrets, so that fighting, as it were, from an eminence, and sending fresh men constantly to relieve the fatigued, and at the same time attempting the town on all